Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Linden. My guest today is Rodney Shakespeare. It's good to have Rodney back. He's professor of binary economics at Trisakti University. It's a Indonesian university, but Rodney is based in London. He teaches postgraduate Islamic economics and finance. He's also a qualified UK barrister. He's co-founder of the Global Justice Movement. He's a distinguished writer, scholar, lecturer. He's an activist. He says what needs to be said. Rodney, it's great to have you back on again.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, I heard some background noise. I wasn't certain if we had a bad connection, or maybe you made a comment, but you weren't coming in clearly. I could hear you fine when you jumped in.
Well, I can hear you very clearly, and if you can hear me, let's carry on.
Oh, well, I absolutely can. I think we have a good connection. And if we don't, we can always reconnect without a problem. Okay. Even the big networks run into connection problems.
Indeed.
So the alternative media can certainly have its share. But anyway, so much going on. I want to let you jump into what's most on your mind.
Well, I would just like to sort of go in sort of slightly obliquely to the main subjects, but start with an article that you have just written on Hollywood. You discuss that Hollywood has always been connected with Washington, and of course this is the political power in society, and it's the financial power in society. And you do go on to discuss, for example, that particularly during periods of war, the Hollywood industry becomes sort of virtually a propaganda machine. But then that continues outside periods of war and goes into sort of political or propaganda. And of late, of course, we are lumbered with the latest examples of propaganda. One of them is that one on the death of, or alleged death on Osama bin Laden. And the other one is that distorted account of a historical event, which was Iran in 1979-1980. I think that one's called Orgo. All this I find is very, very interesting, because I've just come back from two remarkable weeks in Iran. And there, what was happening was that there was a great big sort of overall film festival. And then part of that, for 4 days, was a sort of subpart of it with about 200 people, and there were about 35 to 45 foreign guests, dealing with the subject of Zionism and film. And here you see you're looking at a much more specific aspect of influence on the film industry. This went on for 4 days, and after that we were going around giving lectures, always giving interviews and meetings, etc., etc. Now, on the Zionism thing, there were some startling papers and presentations. One of them was by Kevin Barrett, and he was saying that the 9/11 is really to be seen in terms of a film presentation, and one which he used deep psychological techniques to shock and confuse, and then, having done that, to implant the version that the authorities wanted to implant into the minds of everybody. And now, of course, you've got the problem where the scale of the lie is so big that people just say, well, it's utterly impossible that a government would murder 3,000 of its own citizens. But we had presentations like that, and it was a very, very interesting time the conference was. And if I can just jump immediately to one of the events after the conference, which is on the Sunday, one of the Sundays about 2 weeks ago, was it, I think it was, when we were taken and invited to join the crowds celebrating the Iranian Revolution. And this was rather important, you see, because whilst I was actually at the conference, somebody, and I will not state the name, but somebody I suspect might have connections with American intelligence agencies, was pressing me for what was the evidence that there is a strong, or what is the evidence for the strength of the opposition to the regime in Tehran? You can see the person's mind was going, or government mind, is trying to find out what may be the situation in June when there's another presidential election. And I said to this person, I said, look, if you want to find out, go to the celebrations or not of the revolution which were coming up. Now, that person did not attend those celebrations. I did, in the company in particular of some tall Americans, on that in a moment. The crowds were immense. They were sort of funneling into the boulevards, going down to Freedom Square, and there were speeches, of course, coming over the loudspeakers. And we would be, because physically we stood out as different, we were quick, and there was one member of our group was in fact in a wheelchair. We stood out very quickly as being different in the crowd. And in no time, of course, we were being pulled off onto scaffolding and things to make little speeches to the crowd. And what was extraordinary was how we were received. Individually, the response was absolutely friendly. And when we were in a group, the response was absolutely friendly. But at the same time, the crowd also implanted in our minds a very clear message that the crowd objected to the policies of the American government. I don't think I've ever been in any, well, I haven't been anywhere near such a democratic demonstration as that day. It's very clear that the whole of Iran, if it's attacked in any way, they are completely and utterly united. This was believed to be the biggest demonstration ever in Iran. It comes, of course, when the Iranians feel that they are under threat of being attacked. It confirms, incidentally, what I saw for myself 4 years ago when I was in Tehran just before the presidential election. And there were members in our group who spoke Farsi, and they went toddling off down the markets, etc., because they had friends and things. And we had no doubt then that the result was over two-thirds or over for Ahmadinejad and one-third for Mousavi. Well, this time we were not in a presidential situation. We were only with the bulk of the population, broadly reaffirming their support for their country at a time when it's under threat. And I have to say that sanctions are having no impact on the psychology of the Iranians. They are having an impact on those who are ill, who are not getting the medicines. But in other respects, the Iranians simply are proud people. They will not be bullied or forced. And this idea that you can use sanctions and that you either stimulate opposition to the regime or that you will change Iranian policy away from having its own nuclear civilian program is complete and utter nonsense. I would point out something here, Steve, that if you want to actually change Iran's nuclear policy, the most obvious way to do it is simply to remove all the sanctions and then see whether Iran would just say, oh, well, okay, we've got lots of gas, we've got lots of oil, and the one I point out, lots and lots of solar capacity. I mean, they've got the mountains for it and the sun, and they've got all that. And then see whether they really want to continue in the modern world with nuclear energy. But as the situation is at this moment, it's a matter of national dignity and human pride. Sanctions have not changed Cuba since it had sanctions in 1959. Sanctions on a ghastly war didn't change Iran 1980 to 88. And the idea, it's a bully mentality. It's a bully mentality that thinks that you can put sanctions on Iran and it will change them from alter their course of politics. It will do nothing of the sort.
Rodney,
so there you are, a little word.
I absolutely agree with you 100%. And at the same time, I have written so much about Iran. I've written many times about the sanctions alone. I call them immoral and lawless. The idea of putting sanctions on a non-belligerent country for any reason has no legitimacy, especially when these sanctions really They target the economy, not so much the government. They target ordinary people to inflict pain, and the nonsensical notion that fails every single time, because sanctions go back many years against many different countries, and the idea is to separate the population from its own government, make the people blame the government for the pain that's inflicted on them. Well, people aren't stupid in other countries. Iranians aren't stupid. They don't blame their government. They point fingers the right way. They blame Washington. They blame Israel. They blame complicit European governments. They're the ones responsible. And when they come out en masse supportive of their government, Rodney, it has never been anything in U.S. history that comes anywhere near close to something like this. The only time you get masses on the street in America is when they oppose the government, not when they support it. But there can be millions of Iranians coming out on the street supportively for their government. And one more thing about the nuclear program. I've said this so many times. The issue with America and Israel and the rest of them has got nothing to do with its nuclear program. It's a pretext. It's red herring cover for regime change. In Iraq, it was non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Against Gaddafi, it was a whole bunch of stuff, you know, Viagra to the troops and the rest of it. Rubbish, lies, one lie after another. They're easy to invent. If Iran had no nuclear program, they'd come up with another pretext. The issue is replacing an independent government with a pro-Western puppet state. That's what it's all about. Same in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria. The same dirty game keeps repeating. That's what the face of imperialism is. That's my speech.
Yes, that is right. It is purely about regime change. The fact that all 16 American intelligence agencies. It seems impossible for a country to have 16 intelligence agencies, but the USA does have. They are consistent in saying that Iran is not building a bomb. The IAEA only about 2 weeks ago also said the same. And yet, with that evidence, and there is no better or stronger evidence, we have this eternal snipe, and smear coming from somewhere in the sources of Zionism. And they cannot have got any better evidence than the American intelligence agencies and the IAEA. The thing is an outrage. It's purely about regime change because Iran stands basically, on the key issue, is opposition to the expansion of Israel into other people's lands. I mean, here again, in the last two or three weeks, Israel has started to drill for oil in the Golan Heights. This is in Syria. All we know, in the last two or three weeks, there's been a vast increase in the settlements in Palestine. And, of course, every day, totally unreported on the Western media, there is some sort of nasty attack. Remember that the depleted uranium is doing its dirty work in Gaza, but every day you get somebody shot or some farmer blown up by the Israelis in Gaza. And it is the opposition to the expansion of Israel which lies behind the attempt to overthrow the regime, and also which lies behind all Western policy, right the way throughout the Middle East and in all sorts of respects. At any rate, I just thought we'd talk about your article. I wrote an R. Well, there's another aspect to this thing. I wrote an article on Zionism and Hollywood for the conference, and I think it was quite a good article.
It was a good article. I didn't read it, Rodney.
You couldn't have read it because you said, well, I won't go into the complications. But the point is, I tore the article up. I'm just coming round to that in a second. The article actually pointed out that you had to explain why Hollywood became and has become so violent. And there's obviously a proclivity, a tendency towards violence in America's history, etc. But the article argued, and I'm not the only person to say so, I discovered, for example, that Mark Glenn takes a similar view, that it looks as though Zionist forces recognize that if they were to achieve their aim of an independent state for themselves in the lands of others, they would have to not only link on to a world power, which was at one stage the UK, but then it then became the USA. But that power must be persuaded or developed and be prepared to use violence in a big way, because without that violence, and we're not talking domestically, but in a willingness to do this in its outside its foreign policy, there could not be the establishment and the maintenance of a state in the lands of others. That was my particular theme. But when I got there and started to sniff around, I took a major decision, one which I'm proud of. I got hold of my paper. I went to the organizers. I said, look, if you don't mind, I'm ripping it up. Because the quality of the people there was quite extraordinary. You had 35 very independent people, and all had got one great characteristic, Stephen, which you will recognize. It was not only that in their own way, and they were a mixed bag, that in their own way that they believe in justice and fight for justice, but they had the other aspect is that all of them, particularly when you got to know them, and I know a little bit about most of them, is they've all suffered on behalf of justice. That is to say, they've lost a job, or they've lost whole careers, or they've been persecuted. But every one of them was someone you take your hat off to. And so I thought, well, here's an opportunity. I will rip up my Zionism paper, be it right or wrong, it goes. And instead, I will go for the big thinking. And I went, taking the opportunity, I wrote a paper there and then during one day of the conference, during the second day of the conference, and I wrote it on the big political and economic issues, and I called it New Paradigm Thinking. And I went for it then, and I think it was of great interest. It certainly gave a different flavor to the conference, and it developed it in a way which it was developing naturally. The theme of Hollywoodism was actually rather too narrow for a four-day conference, and it very easily moved on to the big political and economic issues. So there you are. That's what I got up to. And, of course, there were plenty of other things during the 2 weeks. But the celebration of the revolution and the sheer quality of the foreign guests, these are things which I think really do stay in the mind.
Oh, very impressive. You really did have a long trip, and it's been a while since I took a trip. I went to Mexico a year ago, December, and I understand how there can be more things involved than simply the event that you go for. I was lucky enough with one other, to be interviewed on television. I want to say it was more than Mexican television. I went to Mexico. It was more than Mexican television. I'm sorry, it wasn't television. It was radio. I was on television as well, and it went to all of Latin America. Others were on as well. I was on Mexican radio that went beyond Mexico, and I'm not certain what the breadth of the transmission was, but I think it went to a number of countries in the region. And the way we did it in both cases was different for you. You can do it. You can do it in English. You could do it in French or whatever, or Farsi. But I'm sure you did your interviews in English. I did mine in English because I don't speak Spanish, and I needed to have a translator either stand beside me or sit beside me. So I had to jot down some comments. Well, I jotted them down for one brief interview, and the other went on for a good bit longer, so I didn't jot it down. But I had to make my comments extremely brief so the translator could translate, and then I could go on to another comment and do it without losing my train of thought.
Well, Steve, there are actually I must have done, say, 30 or 40 interviews at least during that conference, and then all the ones afterwards, and so were all the other people. You've never seen such a flock of journalists and modern technology. But most people were familiar with the techniques. It depends on the program, depending on how you're doing it. And some of the time, you speak one short sentence and have it translated. And the other time, you speak slowly, and your voice is faded. And then in the actual program itself, your voice is done in Farsi or in Arabic or in any of the other languages. It was a multilingual occasion with highly competent translators and high technology. Okay, now, amongst other things that have come out recently, one of them, Kevin Barrett was there at the conference, and I caught a few minutes of a broadcast that he was doing, I think this Monday, and he was talking to two Limeys, two Brits, Tony Rook and Ian Henschel. And Tony Rook had refused to pay a tax. That tax is called the broadcasting fee. We all have to pay $145, that's $70, $210, $220 a year for the BBC. And so if you have a television set, then that's it. You have to pay the tax. And he objected and said, well, he wasn't going to deal with BBC because, in fact, it had been thoroughly corrupted. And I believe that to be true. I mean, I will not watch the BBC or television now, and I can't stand the newspapers like the Times. But his point was specifically on 9/11. And what he said was this. Is that at 10 to 5 on the afternoon of 9/11, there was the BBC in the form of its reporter, Jane Stanley, reading from a piece of paper supplied by Reuters, saying that another building, Tower Number 7, had been blown up and it had collapsed into powder. And it hadn't. Now, the point is this, is that the BBC had foreknowledge and did nothing about it. And to this day, the BBC has never explained or even been questioned about where did the piece of paper come from Reuters that was given to Jane Stanley. In other words, the BBC is hiding the thing up. But the point about that broadcast, Tony Rook, was he was saying that we had had discussions with the British police, and they were certainly saying, well, we're looking at some form of major crime. The problem is, Steve, is that, of course, dealing with a crime in somebody else's jurisdiction, in this case the USA, in practice, I mean, it's obvious that something was criminal. It's obvious that the thing is a false flag, and it's obvious that Tower Number 7 was deliberately demolished. But to actually get locus standi, the ability to stand in a court and fight the thing in America, seems to be most unlikely. But at long last, some authorities in the UK are beginning to see that 9/11 is most peculiar indeed.
Well, I do. I didn't see the live broadcast of Jane Stanley. 30 minutes before Building 7 went down, she announced that it had come down, crumbled. Well, she will never live that down for the rest of her. I don't know what she's doing now. Maybe she's rebuilding.
I can tell you that.
What is she doing?
She will not discuss it.
She won't discuss it.
There's a most remarkable interview on the internet. Paul, I can't quite find the name, but there was another British journalist who was interviewing her at the time. And this, what is really astonishing is that when he was interviewed and he was asked about this, that he was talking to Jane Stanley when she was announcing something and they could see in the background that the building had not fallen. His mind is as though he's been brainwashed. He denied that he'd been there. He then said, well, this was the timing was wrong. He was in the theater. And then eventually it was pointed out to him, and he was shown, and he just said, well, I must have been. It's as though all his memory has been changed. And that is the point which is being made by Kevin Barrett. He said, and he explained the psychological techniques as to how it's done, he's saying that on 9/11, a colossal act of brainwashing, and then using, he explained how you confuse people, you disturb them, you put in massive fear, and then you give them a simple new solution, which is so big that it cannot be challenged, because to challenge it would be to sort of destroy everything that you stand for. And this is true of Paul Hayter. I think it is Paul Hayter. I think that's the journalist. And the man is obviously telling the truth. But the point is, a great act of psychological brainwashing was done on the whole world, and the evidence of it is Tower Number 7. But you can see that interview, Jane Stanley. Actually, some of the interviews, if you have to Google Jane Stanley with S-T-A-N-D, because her name is spelt wrongly, but it is there on the internet.
Well, I've seen
okay,
it.
Then.
It's been a long time, Rodney, but I have seen her infamous video. Yes, Stanley, S-T-A-N-D-L-E-Y. There
yes, that's the miswriting. It's the misprint. It should be just S-T-A-N. Yep.
Oh, it should just be S-T-A-N, but I think if you,
yes.
if you Google with
whoever
a D,
put it up got it wrong the first time.
Oh, then I have spelt it wrong.
But the point, well, doesn't matter. The point is she refuses to talk about it. Just as, the, you know, there are people connected with 9/11 in the USA. At the conference in Tehran, there was that very big, handsome fireman who gave his experience of 9/11. He refused to accept an award, so he's been smashed out of regular work, and he actually makes his living by going round giving a illustrated and very dramatic account of his experiences in the terrifying circumstances of the collapse of the buildings. But we asked him afterwards. We just said, well, what is your view on this? And Steve, I don't want to put words into his mouth. I'm just going to say that that man has to maintain his own life. And so he gives a very accurate account of his experience in saving people in the ghastly circumstances of the morning of 9/11. But that he was, put it like this, circumspect and must be circumspect if he's to maintain his life as to what he really thinks about the situation.
Oh, indeed. And of course, the 9/11 story, the major event of our time. And I mean, there's simply no, I mean, the evidence is so overwhelming. I can't imagine why anybody with any sense at all thinks it wasn't a put up job, a false flag. So obvious. Been discussed on this program a number of times.
Yes. Okay. Well, now let's look to something which might cheer us up. On the other hand, it might so depress us. They do say if you ever want to get a point across, you should do it in the form of a joke. Well, I'm not very good at telling jokes, and I don't always see other. Steve, I have to confess that American humor is too quick for me, all right? I appreciate somebody's character and that character sort of having an interaction in a particular situation. And I think that's a British characteristic. We like and appreciate that. But American humor, I wake up to the joke about 10 or 20 seconds after everybody else. Just seems to be a little weakness. But anyway, here's one, and it's not a joke, really, but here it comes. Saudi Arabia, a financier of terrorists, an armorer of terrorists, a promoter of the vicious Wahhabism upon which terrorists thrive, hosted a conference on how to counter terrorism. Now, I don't know whether you, when you see that one, whether you laugh or cry. I mean, you know, the cartoonists had a bit of a field day, and the comics got weeks of joke out of it. And I'm sure that depressed people everywhere were being cheered by the thought that the high and mighty, in the case of the Saudis, the very high and arrogant and mighty, most definitely have got feet of clay. But there you are. Would you believe it, that this is what the world has come to? The Saudis, the progenitors, the financiers of terrorism, the ones who are behind Wahhabism, and the Wahhabism, which was behind the men who were part of the 9/11 collapse, for example, the Wahhabism which is leading to the throat slitters and the death squads in Syria, for example, that the Saudis were holding a conference on how to counter terrorism. Would you actually believe it?
That really is hard to believe. That is hard to believe. Rodney, we're coming up to a break, and while you were speaking just now, I tried to see if I could find the infamous Jane Stanley video. I think I did. Let's take a break now briefly. When we come back, let me just play a few seconds of Jane Stanley. The tape runs about It says 9 minutes and 26 seconds. I'm already 35 seconds into it before she comes on, and it's titled on the BBC, Terrorism Attacks in U.S. Anyway, I thought a few seconds of that might be a golden oldie.
A few seconds of that could be a good idea. Okay, Steve, I'll see you later after the break.
We'll be right back after a short break. Rodney Shakespeare. Rodney, Jane Stanley. Any way she wants to spell her name is fine for me. She'll go down in the infamy Hall of Fame. Here's just a brief sample of what Jane had to say.
Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy. There's almost a sense downtown in New York behind me, down by the World Trade Center, there's just an area completely closed off as the rescue workers try to do their job. But this isn't the first building that has suffered as a result. We know that part of the Marriott Hotel next to the World Trade Center also collapsed as a result of this huge amount of falling debris from 110 floors of the two twin towers of the World Trade Center. As you can see behind me, the Trade Center appears to be still burning. We see these...
Whoops, did I get cut off?
Well,
anyway, I didn't hear her say Building 7.
Huge
oh, there it is.
Smoke and ash, and we know that behind that there's an empty piece of what was a very familiar New York skyline, a symbol of the financial prosperity of this city, but completely disappeared now, and New York is still unable to take on board what has happened to them today.
Presumably there were very few people in the Salomon building when it collapsed. I mean, there were, I suppose, fears of possible further collapses around the area.
Was the Salomon building, Building 7?
That's what you would hope, because yes. The whole downtown area behind me has been completely sealed off and evacuated, apart from the emergency.
Anyway, this goes on for 9.5 minutes.
Okay, well, you've done enough there, Steve. The point is, these very British accents. Okay, but the man, Paul, who was interviewing, when he was first asked about this, and this would be about 2 or 3 years ago, his memory had gone. It's as though he had been brainwashed, and eventually he was brought round to recognizing he had been there, that is him, and it is him interviewing. But you see, the whole thing goes on, totally unreal, that the building, as they were speaking, was standing in the background. Oh.
Well, you know, I don't know this guy. I was looking at the background, and I'm looking, but I wouldn't recognize one building. The Twin Towers, of course, would stand out. Anybody would recognize them. But most of the other buildings, they're all skyscrapers. It would be very hard to distinguish one from another. So I looked at the background, and I simply didn't know what building she was talking about. There was smoke coming up as I looked at it, but again, I couldn't tell. And, of course, Building 7 was still standing, and she's reporting that it's gone down.
Well, yes. In most of the videos, that they very usually there's an arrow pointing out where Building 7 is, and there was Building 7. There was some fire in there, but it was only a small amount of fire, and of course the official explanation is that the fire caused it to go down. But if you actually look at the videos of the actual collapse. Of the 7-second free fall collapse, you look at the one which wasn't been manipulated. One of the videos have been issued by the CNN or somebody in the USA, and they've actually painted out the key part, which is that on the roof there was a penthouse, and if you're looking at the Building 7, you actually see the penthouse collapse. Because that means all the struts beneath it have been blown away, and then you see the whole thing sort of caving towards the center and the whole building come down in a free fall. Anyway, thank you for bringing that one up, and now Steve, I've got the two other subjects. I've got so much to deal with today. I'd like to move on to the quick word on a hero, Bradley Manning. And then I'd like, if I may, to move on to what is happening in Italian politics, because I think it's highly significant and has a big message. So let's go on Bradley Manning. You have written on this young man who's at long last has revealed to the world that they're lying their heads off all the time, and revealed, for example, that Saudi Arabia wants to attack Iran all the time. Well, of course they do, and the Saudis are cruel, vicious barbarians, and they want to attack a country which stands, actually does stand, for democracy. Let no one have any misapprehensions. Iran is as democratic as you will get it anywhere in the world. In the USA, money decides everything, and as you pointed out earlier on today, you know, you don't get these democratic demonstrations. But Bradley Manning revealed the truth about so much. And I can't comment as to whether he did in fact leak it to Julian Assange, but the position of Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy still in London is quite disgraceful, because you see that the alleged offence under Swedish law on the facts as given would not constitute any offence under UK law. But, of course, Assange fears that if he is extradited to Sweden, then the Americans immediately put the pressure on Sweden. And, indeed, Sweden wants to extradite him in order to send him to America. So Assange is holed up in an Ecuadorian embassy. I actually think that he will get out of it, that there is a way to do it. You give him nationality, Ecuadorian nationality, and then you make him into a diplomat, and then see whether the UK would be... Well, I don't know, but I think he will eventually get out of it. But the situation is disgraceful, and I just say that Bradley Manning, at a time of crisis in his life, you and I and the listeners, I'm sure, are taking our hats off to him in honour.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. What was done to him could break most people. 10 months in solitary confinement, it was worse than that. They made him sleep naked when he came out of his cell. Oh, yeah.
Noise.
Everything.
Solitary confinement. Yes.
They wanted to break him. They wanted to turn his mind to mush, and they did it to Jose Padilla. And most people, after so many months in isolation, even less oppressively treated than the way Manning was, will break, and they simply won't be the same.
It's called torture. It's quite easy to do that with people. You only have to isolate them. And in no time at all, their natural fears and worries about life in general come to the surface. And they've got you. They've actually got you. But let us honor him as best as we can. And he has admitted to giving out some information. But this idea of aiding the enemy, who is the enemy? Who is now the enemy of democracy? Supposing that the next thing which is going to happen, Steve, is the Saudis will be calling a conference on democracy. And they'll have the Americans and the Israelis and the Saudis and the Qataris. The rest of the world will fall down on the ground with laughter. But who is now the enemy? Who is bringing fascism, drone fascism, to its own country? It's the USA. I'm not, by the way, saying that the UK isn't up to the tricks. But the leader of the move towards fascism at this moment is actually the USA, and that people like Bradley Manning stand for a bit of honor and a bit of openness and a bit of decency, and is actually in his own way a profound Democrat. It's the anti-Democrats who are attacking Manning and trying to shut him up. I mean, what was the big crime? He actually showed that there was the machine gunning of, 20 people, 10 people, I don't know, of people, quite unnecessarily, just like a video game. That sort of thing is disgraceful. The Americans have never, ever apologized for shooting down an Iranian airliner. They've paid compensation, but they've never said, we shouldn't have done it. And that is the key point. When you have arrogant military powers saying that they can kill and never apologize for it, then whose side are we on? I suggest that Bradley Manning should be honored as a Democrat, and those who are persecuting are fascists.
Well, I certainly agree, Rodney. He is a Democrat, and he told people what everyone has a right to know. His government committed war crimes. These are war crimes. The people responsible, not just the ones who pulled the trigger, but the commanders in the field who ordered it, the higher-up commanders who ordered it, the Pentagon commanders, all the way up the chain of command, to the Secretary of Defense, to the Vice President, to the President, all the complicit U.S. officials. They are war criminals. They deserve to be prosecuted. It is a great public service to point this out and present the evidence. It should go to court, and these people should be prosecuted and convicted, and they're the ones who should be put in prison.
Now, Steve, that there's an interesting thing here, that we've had President Hollande being awarded a peace prize just the moment that he puts in the attacks into Mali. He gets awarded the peace prize. We had President Obama getting the peace prize the moment he was elected. I'd like to see what the Nobel Prize Committee does for its next award. And I would like to suggest that if it had any guts at all, it would give a peace prize to Private Bradley Manning.
Well, I would love to see that, too. I think the chances of that would be something like a beach day in Chicago in January, Rodney. Oh, indeed. Well, an Islamic organization that I mentioned in my article a couple of years ago nominated Bradley Manning for the Nobel Peace Prize. And right here in my own city, Kathy Kelly, who lives about, maybe 10 miles north of me, although she travels the world, so she's away more than she's at home, she's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize at least twice. She went during the 1990s, and I think up to and including the Iraq War. She made 25 trips to Iraq, and I believe she was there during the 2003 shock and awe. She put her life on the line. Nobody pays her 10 cents. She does it because it's the right thing. There is another heroic woman who deserves a Nobel Peace Prize.
Person. Absolutely splendid. It would be nice if some of these people actually do get the prize, as opposed to Hollande and Obama. Now, Steve, time is moving on. I'd like to move, if I may, on now to the subject of Italy. And indeed, there are some remarkable videos that you can see of someone called Beppe. That's B-E-P-P-E, Beppe, a Grillo. Now, a Grillo is a comedian. And I have to say that his sheer skills in what's called working an audience has to be seen. He has a microphone which is just next to his mouth, and so his hands are free, and he moves in and around the audience and gets their responses and puts his message across in a very effective way. Now, he is the leader of the five-star movement in Italy, which has just got itself roughly 25% of American politics, which from a party coming from nowhere to, you know, to 25% is absolutely astonishing. One of the consequences, of course, is that Italian politics is paralyzed, and although you can't have an election immediately, there's another election coming down the pike, perhaps in 6 months or 8 months' time. But I do say to listeners that they might also Google, I don't know what to Google, but perhaps Grillo will give the sufficient information, Beppe Grillo, or Italian five-star movement or something, to look at one of the or two of these videos of him working the audience. One of them I saw, it starts with about 2 minutes of him just speaking in Italian. I don't speak Italian, but I was fascinated to see him moving around the audience. You don't need to understand what he was saying. And then in come the subtitles. And it was interesting is that one thing was very clear. He was blaming the financial structure for creating money out of nothing, adding interest unnecessarily, and putting it in all the wrong places, and then try controlling everybody by putting them into debt. And he raises all the questions in this particular area. He is saying that the debt must be repudiated. That's the government debt must be repudiated. Basically making a huge attack on the banking system. And in a fundamental way, Steve, that has to be done, because unless an attack is made on the banking system, the debt, which is now out of hand in country after country, is going to get more and more, and you're leading to a situation of a global elite controlling everybody by just simply by putting them into more and more debt, though your creditors always control your lives. The other aspect of Grillo, of two other aspects, is that he wants to come out of the euro, and that is probably right, since the European Central Bank is not, it's only going to create money for the benefit of bailing out bankrupt banks and increasing their bonuses, instead of putting the money directly into, for example, public capital projects. I mean, there's nothing new in this. America did it. I mean, look at your Hoover Dam. And ask how that was financed, a remarkable achievement. Look at your Tennessee Valley Authority in the USA. Nothing new about this. But the Europe is simply not doing it, because, as like in the early stages of the 1930s, it's in the grip of a corrupt system which is thinking of nothing but itself and has no understanding or comprehension or desire to consider the interests of the mass of the population. But Grillo is hitting on something. There are aspects of him which frankly are Poujadist, a bit narrow-minded and a bit silly, and some of his policies contradict other policies. But he does represent now, for the first time, a major political assault on the whole of the system. Occupy Wall Street in the USA also represents such an assault, but at the moment in the USA, it hasn't got the political purchase on the situation. It hasn't sort of manifested itself in people in the political institutions. I mean, you've had your Tea Party coming up from one sort of angle, but an attack at the whole of the society or the institutions being wrong hasn't really manifested itself in strong numbers of votes in the USA. But it has done that in Italy. It is most certainly will do that the moment that the Greeks get a chance. There are big issues over France. So something very fun, and Spain, goodness me, in Spain, young people under 25, 56.5% are unemployed. And in Andalusia, young people, 68% are unemployed. Something is fundamentally happening. I'm not saying that they've got the solution, but they are at least starting to focus on saying that the whole system is profoundly wrong and getting worse, and that something has to be done.
It really is profoundly wrong, and I've written so much about the system. The two books that I had on Wall Street and banker occupation, I mean, it focuses right to the heart of what's wrong with the system. It's basically one that enriches major corporations, especially bankers at the top of the queue, and rich elites. And it's in Western society, it's in America, it's in Israel. Unfortunately, it's in other places as well. And it comes, but mostly in the West, and absolutely in Israel, that ranks as one of the most three unjust OECD countries. You've got to go to places like Mexico to find a country. Maybe Mexico is the wrong example, but I think maybe one or two countries that are a little bit less developed that rank ahead of the injustice that goes on in Israel. But of the major Western developed countries, the three most unequal, and I'm not sure in which order, but the three most unequal are America, Israel, and Britain. What a testimony to their governments. And things aren't getting better. They're getting worse. The wealth disparity is unprecedented. It's widening even more. And the idea in Europe, they call it austerity. They call it austerity in America as well. And now we've got this sequester nonsense. And the only the idea of a fiscal cliff, well, there really isn't a debt fiscal cliff as such. There's an economic fiscal cliff. And it's all manufactured, because if money is injected into the economy to stimulate growth. Growth produces jobs. Jobs puts money in people's pockets. When they have money, they spend it. It stimulates most growth. But when you hand the wealth of the nation, printed by the central banks, to bankers and other corporate favorites, and they use it to make mergers and pay themselves big salaries and bonuses and speculate, and you do nothing to create jobs, and they fatten their bottom line by cutting jobs, because a great way to increase profits isn't just by increasing sales, it's by cutting expenses. And what expense matters more than people? That by far is the biggest one. So they lop off people left and right, they grow their profits, and the main profit driver in the last few years for Western corporations has been less their revenue, which really hasn't grown particularly well. It's been the cost cutting. I'm not sure how much they have to do, but this is the way they've made so much money, raised their stock prices, and Obama claims to be a job creator. Obama is a job destroyer. European governments are job destroyers. That's what the system is all about, Rodney. It's a sick, corrupt, destructive system, and the poverty levels are off the charts. The unemployment level in America, it's 23%. It's not the 7, 8, or 9% that they claim. Maybe they manipulate the European numbers as well, but the number you quoted for Spain, over half the young people in the country are unemployed. The same thing pretty much, I think, is the case in Greece. And the overall unemployment rate, they listed at about 25, 26%. I think it's higher than that.
You double it for the young people.
Oh, indeed. But I think the overall rate is manipulated.
You mentioned cost cutting. The cost cutting is exporting the jobs, because you see, if you just look at it from the perception of the shareholders of the international corporations, you cut the costs if you can cut the labor costs. And that is why America has exported 56,000 enterprises, about 8 million jobs. And as you were indicating just now, each job that you have creates another 4 jobs. And so therefore 32 million jobs have gone out from the American economy and not coming back.
Oh, absolutely. Can I mention one thing briefly, and then we have a couple of minutes left, and I want to give it to you. I have another article on this coming out tomorrow. I titled it Austerity When Stimulus Is Needed. I begin on December 31, 1933, the New York Times published John Maynard Keynes' open letter to Franklin Roosevelt. He gave him a checklist of what he needed to do to stimulate the economy. I list the key points, but just the top one makes the point. The London Guardian reprinted it in November 2008, and one of his key points was spend, quote unquote.
Yes.
In other words, inject
as
money
long
into
as
the
it's
economy.
Not borrowed money, borrowed from the banks at interest. But in fact, in your case, it should be your Treasury creating it. The banks can administer it, but
you can't trust the banks; they've
been betrayed. And Steve, you will be on a winner with that article, because everywhere now you go, and recently I'm noticing they're beginning to understand at last that you've got to address this issue of, in the first place, public capital projects. Then you've got environmental capital projects. Then you've got clean electricity. Then you've got spreading the ownership in the big corporations. Then you've got state housing, government housing and private housing, which can be done interest-free and just charging the administration cost. Then you've got small businesses, and if they've got collateral, you've got to actually say, we will address the real economy and its spreading. We will not address the interests of a global financial elite who don't care a damn about you or anybody else. We need this fundamental paradigm change, and your article will be hitting on it and coming at a time, and it will be getting a good and positive response.
Well, I hope so. There is no question. If I had to point to one key that is destroying the economies of America and the West, it's the criminal bankers who literally have a business plan based on grand theft, fraud, and governments go along with it. They profit. They do it at the expense of most other people. So poverty is out of control. I mean, countries' economies are being wrecked. The numbers are rigged. That they're being turned into dystopian backwaters. And things are literally spinning out of control. They'll get worse. We've got about a minute left, Rodney. Let me give you the final comments.
Well, Steve, I should like to say, first of all, that you on 9/11, it's going to break at some stage. We have to have the courage and keep going. Secondly, I do commend you and your listeners for the fact that you are one of the breaths of fresh air and of light and hope on the American scene, because I mean your mainstream media are an absolute disgrace, but people are turning to the alternative media. They are picking up the message, and I feel that this year, towards the end of this year, there's some big events coming and there's some big change coming, and you are rightly putting out the new thinking in advance of the great economic collapse, which I believe is coming within the next 6 or 8 months.
Rodney,
we have to get the ideas out, because if we don't,
indeed,
fascism will prevail.
I've got to wrap up about a time. I absolutely agree with you. It's coming. I can't predict when, but it will come, and the longer it's delayed, the bigger the bang when it finally hits. Rodney, another great program. I look forward to getting you back next month. I'll just wrap up by reminding my listeners to tune in again tomorrow. Same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays, same time. And on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, make it a regular habit.